Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us this morning. In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking with Murray Sperber, a man who is one of the nation's best-known critics of college sports. He has been frequently interviewed by such news organizations as New York Times, LA Times, also National Public Radio and ABC News. He's professor of English and American Studies at Indiana University in Bloomington and has written several books about college sports, including the book College Sports Incorporated that came out back in 1991, Shake Down the Thunder from 93, and Onward to Victory from 98. Today, we'll be talking about his most recent book, which is titled Beer and Circus, and the subtitle is How Big-Time College Sports is Crippling Undergraduate Education. The publisher on the book is Henry Holt, and it's just recently come out. In the book, he deals with two separate subjects that he sees as very much connected. That is, on the one hand, the issue of whether or not it's appropriate for colleges and universities to operate multi-million-dollar basketball and football programs that constitute, in effect, a feeder system for the NFL and the NBA. That's one question. The other is what's happening with undergraduate education and the concern that many people have at colleges and universities around the country that the quality of undergraduate education is not what it should be. He sees these two things as being related, and we'll talk about that. And, of course, if you're interested in reading more, you can go on and look at the book, which is available now. And, of course, questions also are welcome. We just ask one thing of callers, that you try and be brief in your comments so that we can keep things moving along and accommodate as many different people as possible. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And if you match the numbers to the letters on the phone there, you'll get WILL. So 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, Professor Sperber, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And thanks for talking with us once again.
Thank you. I've been on for every book, and I've enjoyed this immensely. I'm also, my wife and I also, I guess you call it subscribers to WIL?
Yeah, I guess that's one of the words
right,
we use.
Yeah. We get your magazine and such, and hear you very clearly in Bloomington, Indiana.
Well, that's great. Well, let's talk about a little bit about these two things. And
okay.
The first issue is one that you have written about over the course of several books and have talked a lot about, and that is that the feeling that maybe the mission of the university being educational and research
right.
Somehow doesn't quite line up with the operation of these multi-million-dollar entertainment enterprises that that do indeed constitute a farm system for the NFL and the NBA. Can you give us the thumbnail sketch, and I know that we could talk about this for an entire hour.
Sure.
But supposing that a university simply decided that they wanted to do this, why is that a problem, and why is it that the university couldn't continue to fulfill its mission, its educational mission, and at the same time
right.
have a Division I-A sports program?
Well, I guess the main problem, if you put it in a world perspective, for one thing, the United States is the only country that does this. I'm a Canadian originally, and even in Canada, system and higher education system, quite close to the American one, Canadian universities don't see themselves as farm teams for professional sports, and it's not simply in basketball or in football. Large numbers of players in the National Hockey League, for instance, are Canadians who left Canada and had the choice at 18 of either going into minor league hockey or going into the other version of it, American college hockey. And no players come out of Canadian college hockey, for instance, because they don't give scholarships and it's not a big thing. And actually, other sports now, something like half of the American-born players in Major League Baseball played college ball. So it's across the board as well as the Olympic sports. And I guess the main thing is, where do the players come from within the university? And they are classified as students. Now, unfortunately, my research showed that they're really vocational students. They're students working full-time jobs in very intensive training programs, 30, 40, sometimes 50 hours a week, and they've got to fit in going to school around the margins of this full-time job. Their athletic scholarships are essentially one-year contracts. They're renewed every July, basically at the behest of their coach, often for athletic performance, so they're under the thumb of their coach. And I know some parents and the public think this is a wonderful opportunity for a free education, and it is at one level, but at another level, if you're part of the deal is this very intensive full-time job, it's hard to get an education. And I think a lot of the abuses that we hear about, the academic tutoring scandal at Minnesota or Mickey Mouse courses and such for athletes, are a result of this system. I don't blame the athletes. I've met, in fact, over the years, I've met very few dumb jocks. What I have encountered over and over again are physically and mentally exhausted athletes who academically underachieve when they're in their sports. The proof to me is athletes out of season, or particularly after their eligibility is over, either through 4 years or through injury, and they're able to go to school full-time, and they're often wonderful students. The discipline that they've learned in sports, they can apply to going to class and going to school. They're much better students than my collegiate frat rat beer-drinking type students who never get with the academic program, never there on Fridays or Mondays, and Thursdays are washed out for them. So I came to admire the athletes, but I really saw them as caught up in a system much bigger than they are, and they're not the adults here. It's the people running the universities who design this system. So it seems to me it's quite a dysfunctional system.
But one of the proposals that you make at the conclusion to the book that you think would address some of the problems with college sports is you say that we should end athletic scholarships. And I would imagine that there are some people that would argue that for the students that are in the non-revenue sports, things like golf and tennis or soccer or volleyball, those sorts of things, that for many of them, these kinds of scholarships are very important because it may make the difference between them going to college and not. And by getting rid of the dealing with the problem at the level of things like hockey or basketball or football, that then you penalize a lot of other kids who are in a different tier of the system.
Well, it's interesting that you phrased the question that way. That's the first time, David. Usually people say to me, you're going to penalize minority youngsters in football and basketball. And I say, no, the whole idea of ending athletic scholarships is to move them from under the thumb of the athletic department, and particularly the coach, as we were talking before, to the financial aid office. In that situation, a student qualifies as long as he or she needs financial aid and is making academic progress. So if, you know, many athletes, because of their athletic scholarship, are steered by the athletic department into Mickey Mouse courses, even when they want harder courses, but the athletic department wants to keep them eligible to play. So if you took that sort of control over the athlete away from the athletic department and gave it to the financial aid office like every other student, the student athlete would be more independent. As far as the sports you name, I mean, it's a kind of perfect example. Many, many athletic scholarship winners in this sport, these sports, are middle-class kids and who don't need the scholarship. In fact, the university could use that scholarship money to give it to more minority youngsters without athletic ability. I mean, finally, the university should be giving scholarships on the basis of academics, not on athletic talent. I know in the 1950s when the NCAA approved athletic scholarships, the Ivy League, which had founded big-time college sports, in a sense departed from the mainstream of the NCAA, and they said, we see athletic scholarships as a way of paying young people to come to a school to play a sport. This has got nothing to do with higher education as we see it. And they refuse to give athletic scholarships and don't give them to this day. And at the same time, by the way, the Ivy League decided it would go more academic, and for the first time in its history, it admitted more students from public high schools than from private prep schools, and everybody knows what happened to the Ivy League educationally after that. So it seems to me, if you're a minority youngster and you need financial aid to go to school, you'll certainly qualify with the financial aid office, and the Clinton administration has increased financial aid quite a bit. And if you're from a wealthy Chicago suburb and you win a soccer scholarship and such, I'm not quite sure you should have that if your parents can afford to send you to the U of I or Indiana or wherever. So I really think it, from a social policy point of view, it makes sense.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Murray Sperber. He is a professor of English and American Studies at Indiana University at Bloomington and has written a number of books about college sports. His very first, College Sports Incorporated, came out in 1991. I think every time there has been a book, we've talked about it here on the show. And the new one is titled Beer and Circus, How Big-Time College Sports is Crippling Undergraduate Education. It's published by Henry Holt and Company. And questions welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Let's talk for a moment here about the other part of this equation. And certainly it is the case that that people at universities across the country, particularly very large universities that are known for research and graduate programs, for doing a lot of important research and turning out PhDs, there is concern about the quality of undergraduate education there. And but I think it's also an area that gets a little difficult because one ends up relying on anecdotal information.
Right.
What you did was in an attempt to, an admittedly not completely scientific attempt to gather some information, you conducted, you sent out questionnaires and did some interviews with students, with undergraduates around the country, and asked them what their experience was in an effort to get at this issue.
Right.
What sort of things did they tell you?
Well, actually, I should mention I spent some time at the University of Illinois. I handed out my questionnaires, and then when it was posted on the web, lots of U of I students responded. But I went to a number of classes at Illinois, and one, I handed out my questionnaires, and afterwards we talked about it in a kind of focus group way. I discovered that students are very unhappy with the huge lecture classes that they have to take, particularly as freshmen, that many are very alienated from their studies. And they also love college sports and are, especially if their teams are winning, and are much caught up in it and the party scene that surrounds it. And we can talk about that in a few minutes or so. But one of the, finally, after all my research and such, I really felt I had kind of hit a wall on this question of the quality of undergraduate education, because whenever I called up a school and I asked them, how's undergraduate education at your school, and they'd say, oh, it's great, it's wonderful. And but I'd go there, and certainly the students didn't see it that way, and many of the faculty were quite honest about it. But then I was in Washington, D.C. One day, and in a bookstore there, that had a lot of education books, and I saw this Peterson's Guide to Honors Programs. And essentially what they do is just reproduce what a school says about its honors program. And I began reading in those statements, such as the University of Maryland saying, you know, come to our honors program. They're competing. Their honors program sees themselves as trying to get East Coast students who would go to private small liberal arts schools. And they say, come to our honors program. You'll be in classes of 15 to 20 taught by a full professor. On the other hand, our general undergraduate programs, you'll be in classes of a couple hundred taught by graduate students. And come here and create knowledge with a professor as opposed to you know, our regular undergraduates are memorizing a zillion facts and regurgitating them on exams. And I was sort of shocked that schools would admit this, and across the country, I remember sitting in this bookstore, I started underlining this stuff, and a clerk came up to me and said, sir, you will buy this book, won't you? And I said, I'll not only buy this book, I'll pay 10 times the cover price for it, because it unlocked the key in their own words across the country. I know the University of Oregon says, our honors program teaches students such fundamental skills as reading and writing. And I really did a double take with the word fundamental. I mean, clearly that says the rest of the University of Oregon's not teaching students that. And when I think back on my own experience, I went to Purdue University in the late 50s, early 60s, in the post-Sputnik era, and I had freshman English in a class of 15 students taught by a full faculty member. Every Purdue student did. There was no honors program at that time. And then if you flash forward to the present, I'm teaching freshman English in a class of 150 students, and I can't begin to give my students the training in reading and writing at a college level that I received. And in many ways, that's what prompted the book, my own experiences and my own sense of the decline of undergraduate education. My teachers at Purdue taught four courses a semester, had long office hours, were always available, could work with students. And when I arrived at Indiana University in 1971, it had gone to three courses a semester and very soon to two courses. And essentially, faculty were increasingly hired to do research and promoted and given tenure for research. And in the 1970s, universities began chasing research prestige and pouring billions into their graduate programs and their research programs. But unfortunately, it came at a time when the public was increasingly skeptical about higher education. I think the protests of the 60s had soured many people. Also, Ronald Reagan was rising to political power, and he made his career bashing higher education, first in California and then nationally. And so you have this kind of crunch in higher education and schools beginning to neglect quite seriously undergraduate education. And then just to work in the beer and circus, in 1979, ESPN starts, and it needs to fill 24 hours a day. Various conferences are created. The Big East is created to be on TV every night of the week. And college sports goes from a weekend activity to a nightly activity. And it explodes in popularity, and the main sponsors of college sports are the beer companies, and they begin to target college students and are very successful with campaigns like Spuds McKenzie and such. So in the 90s, all of these trends come together, and schools begin to market their college sports and such. And that's kind of a brief synopsis of the book, actually.
Well, we have a couple of callers. We'll bring them into the conversation. Other people who are listening are certainly welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll start with a caller in Freeport's line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. The millionaire or even multimillionaire owners of so-called teams like the Chicago Bulls exemplify U.S. capitalism at its most extreme, and the whole system in professional sports has prostituted the Olympic ideal of sports for its own sake, of sports without any monetary payment. And in a country like socialist Cuba, for example, all athletic events are open, free to the public. And of course, they get a big attendance. And Cuba has produced one of the best baseball teams. It's a national sport there, of course. Produced one of the best baseball teams in years. They've defeated the U.S. off and on in the Olympics.
And what exactly does this have to do with college sports in the United States?
Well, I'm putting this as an example of what can be done under socialism.
I see. Well, okay.
Well,
I don't know if you want to comment on that, Professor.
Well, I don't think you have to look to Cuba, and that's a very complicated system. But the model that I like is Division III, Quincy. All those schools, those colleges in Illinois, play college sports, but they don't give athletic scholarships. The coaches see themselves much more as teachers than as entrepreneurs chasing million-dollar-a-year revenues, as the big-time college coaches achieve. And The athletes are essentially students, and the sports are played at a low key. They're competitive. They're interesting to watch. They're also free to the public at almost all these schools. And that's the model that I like. And now I realize that's not going to dominate American college sports, but hopefully it can become stronger and stronger.
Yeah, and I certainly hope that people do understand that you're not arguing that college students, that there's something wrong with them having the opportunity to play
sports
when they're in college.
I mean, I come from a sports background and even played semi-pro basketball in France for 2 years. So, I know I'm often accused of being a pointy-headed professor who hates sports, and there are some, I have colleagues like that, but quite the opposite. I come from a pro sports point of view. I just feel that it's out of control in many colleges in this country.
Let's talk with someone in Aurora. This is line one. Hello?
Yeah, my daughter worked at Indiana University for 19 years, and some of the years were spent at HYPA. So I follow anything that happens at Indiana U with very much. She said that 5 years ago, things started to change there. What happened 5 years ago? And my other question is this. Do you think the dumbing of America has prompted what you're doing, and are other universities doing this too?
Let me take the second question first. I do think, I don't talk about the secondary school system and the problem of sports in the secondary school system. I know my daughter went to high school at Bloomington South High School in the 1990s, and I remember one time I got a call from a woman in the Parents Association saying they were raising money for the school, and I said, well, it really needs it. It has about 20 computers for 2,000 students. And she said, oh, no, it's not to buy computers. We're raising money to build a sauna for the football team because they won the state championship, and we want to congratulate them and consolidate their program. So I think when secondary schools do this, they're certainly giving a very anti-educational signal. This is happening across the country. One of the problems for universities is they're admitting huge numbers of students who need remedial help and really can't read and write at a college level, often sometimes at a high school level, and their numeracy is very behind. And so, yes, it is a kind of dumbing of America, and it's a very large problem, much larger than what my book focuses on. As far as Indiana University 5 years ago, I'm not quite sure what event your daughter is referring to. I know I was quite outspoken on the Bob Knight controversy. In fact, I'm not teaching this fall because his fans threatened to invade my classes and such. But I think sometimes people point to the current athletic director, Clarence Doniger, coming here and changing things and trying to put it on a more business-like matter. But I'm not quite sure what that event of 5 years ago. It seems to me I've been here 29 years, and I guess the most important single event was the firing of Bob Knight this September, and that might change things quite dramatically in the athletic department.
Thank you so much.
All right. We're here at our midpoint of this part of Focus 580, and again, I should introduce our guest. We're talking with Murray Sperber. He's professor of English and American Studies at Indiana University in Bloomington and has written several books about college sports, and his most recent is titled Beer and Circus, How Big-Time College Sports is Crippling Undergraduate Education. It's published by Henry Holt. It came out in September and should be in bookstores if you would like to read it. Questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I want to go back to the two themes and how they're connected, because I'm sure that there are people who would agree with you that the ones that undergraduate quality of undergraduate education is a problem, and who might also agree with you that in some places overemphasis on big time sports is a problem. But then they might say, well, what exactly do those two things have to do with each other?
Right. Well, I think in the 1980s, I have a chapter in the book about this. An event occurred at Boston College. It's called the Flutie Factor, subsequently. Doug Flutie, who amazingly is still around and winning football games, but as a college quarterback, he had a number of terrific games on TV, one against the University of Miami at Thanksgiving with a final second Hail Mary pass that won. And then he won the Heisman Trophy. And the next year later, the admissions people at Boston College noticed that there was a 25% jump in applications to Boston College. And they attributed this publicly to the school winning and attracting a lot of attention through Doug Flutie's heroics, and they called it the Flutie factor. Now, what they didn't talk about publicly, but they did acknowledge privately, and my research and other research shows, is that part of that jump also occurred because Boston College had a reputation as a party school, and this increased, and Boston in the 1980s became a hot college town with lots of college bars, and of course the TV series Cheers and such. So schools began chasing this Flutie factor, I mean, to the, and it kept occurring. Right now, for instance, at Michigan State, I was there a couple of weeks ago. They're having a jump in applications because they won the men's basketball championship last spring. And it's one of the famous party schools, certainly, in the Big Ten. And I contend that at these schools, particularly the large public research ones, they're not giving that good an education. In my interviews at Michigan State, for instance, a woman who was a senior said to me, in 4 years at this school, I've had exactly four classes with 25 or less students taught by a full faculty member. And but schools are marketing their beer and circus. If you remember a couple of weeks ago, there was a big controversy at the University of Wisconsin at Madison where they had taken the photo on the application brochure. And it was a photo of students at a football game, and they had added an African-American student through the miracle of computers and Photoshop. And this created all, they wanted to show diversity, and there was a controversy about that. But much more interesting to me was the fact of them using this photo. I mean, students at a football game, if you're a high school senior in Wisconsin or Illinois or in your listening area, you know that Camp Randall Stadium is one of the great alcohol-soaked venues in college sports. So in a sense, Wisconsin is saying, come to Madison for beer and circus. I can assure you in that brochure there were no photos of the huge lecture classes you'll have to take when you enter Wisconsin and or of the undergraduate education there. So schools, in a sense, are really using this because, to attract students, and downplaying the educational problems that they have. So that's basically how I make the connection. Hmm.
Other callers. We have some other folks here locally. Next is Champagne. It's line one. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to get your opinion on, is it the NCAA or colleges trying to push that players get paid? My opinion is... it's ridiculous either way around, because all that will end up doing is making the bigger colleges better at their sports, or,
right.
or more corruption will happen is what I'm getting to.
Well, it's interesting. The NCAA doesn't claim, it claims it's not interested in professionalizing college sports, and schools claim that too, and this has to be put in the context that most schools lose money on their athletic departments. Michigan recently said it lost $3 million last year, and that's Big Blue with that huge 110,000-seat stadium in Chrysler Arena. So where would the money come from to pay them? Meanwhile, the NCAA, I noticed in the paper this week, a committee has proposed and moved along. This has been proposed before. It's called amateur deregulation. And essentially, it allows players, if, say, they go from high school to the pros and they don't make it in the pros, to come back to college. It allows athletes, before they enter college, to take money from for playing sports and various other ways of deregulating amateurism. And it seems to me, whether you like the idea of professionalizing college sports or not, I think it's going to happen, but I think it's going to happen because of the courts. I could see an athlete suing his or her university and saying, my athletic scholarship is an artificial cap on my earnings power. For instance, if you're a player at Michigan State and you won the national championship, but you're in state from Flint or one of these other places the players were from, your athletic scholarship's worth about $15,000. However, you generated millions for Michigan State University. Now, that the athletic department wasted that money has got nothing to do with your generating it. And I could see the courts being very sympathetic to this argument. And, you know, there was a case a few years ago where the NCAA put an artificial cap on the earnings of a group of assistant coaches. And these coaches went to court and said, no, college sports is a commercial entertainment enterprise and the market should prevail. The NCAA said, no, it's all academic. These coaches are like graduate teaching assistants. Well, a jury of 12 ordinary Americans in Kansas City found for the coaches and awarded them $54 million. So I could see a jury finding for the athletes and telling schools they had to pay their athletes a market wage. And I think what would happen is it would transform college sports. I mean, schools would have to decide whether to go to this professional model or not. I think 30 to 40 schools would go. In the Big Ten, for instance, I can't imagine that Northwestern would go that way, but I can't imagine that Ohio State wouldn't. And right. It would be very interesting. At each school, there would be a debate. But one of the results would be you would have this top tier of schools in professional right. college sports, and you'd have all the rest.
Right. It would really segregate. You know, you have the country club, and then you got the rest. And
right. But the rest, it could give a signal to the American public as to who's in the commercial entertainment business and what schools are in higher education and provide a quality education. So it could be positive that way.
Could you touch on the money that's being made from the Final Four in the NCAA? Because every year I hear about, you know, how they're exploiting the kids and how much money is being made on that. And if your team makes it to the Final Four, does the school get a bonus? I think all the money that's generated in the NCAA tournament for basketball should be put into a fund and split evenly amongst the 64 teams instead of the Final Four getting more than the first round guys, because you know you're always going to end up with Duke and all those guys getting the money and everybody else kind of. You know.
Well, they do actually because they were so criticized. On the basis of what you criticized, and there was a famous thing where it did go to the Final Four teams and the winners and such, kept most of it. There was a famous instance in the early 90s where an announcer said that this free throw, which will win the tournament, is like a couple $1 million shot for this school. So the NCAA devised a very complicated formula that, frankly, I can't totally understand, and I've sat down with NCAA people, and they don't totally understand it. But what it does is essentially it splits the money beyond the 64 schools. It goes to conferences. If your team is in, the Big Ten does great, of course, because it has many teams in the tournament. So it gets
just recently,
right? Recently, so it gets a pretty good share. And the further a team goes in the tournament, the more the conference gets. And so in that sense, it's more equitable. Plus, a certain amount of the money. Now, we're talking $6 billion from CBS TV for the tournament through this decade into the next one. So
okay,
you're talking.
One more quick comment, and then I'm gonna let you go. I'm wondering, since Carbondale let the Halloween party back, if that was going to generate more attendance. But since they ruined the party again this year, and they probably won't have it again next year, because you're talking about how partying and enrollment increased in other colleges, and that Halloween party used to be quite famous, and now they ruined it again. All right, thank you.
Okay. You want to comment on that, or should we just go on?
I actually was driving from St. Louis yesterday and heard the Carbondale NPR station, and they had some very good reports on that, and it really seemed to me, here's sort of college partying out of hand in many ways, and schools really have to get control of this whole thing.
Let's go to Urbana, line number two. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
The word that I heard around here was that during the night controversy, your life was threatened. Is that true?
It was, although what I took, what impacted my life more directly was the fact that some of these fans discovered that one way to find me, I guess I should explain, on their enemies list, Neil Reed, the player who night choked, who went public with this, is always number one. And this assistant coach, Ron Felling, who allegedly gave the tape of night choking Reed, was number two. But you can't find these guys. They're lost in America somewhere, although Felling recently emerged. But they don't have home phones. They don't have that are listed. They don't have email addresses and such. But the fans could find me because I work for a public institution. And they also discovered that in the Indiana University schedule of classes, it lists every professor and lists the courses they teach, the room numbers, the times, the day of the week, where they are. And they downloaded this on their website and said, let's invade Sperber's classes and tell him what we think about what he's saying about Bob Knight, who they worship. And my boss and I decided that I couldn't teach under these circumstances, and so that's why I'm on a leave of absence right now. Although I do hope to go back in the spring, although I was just talking to the IU campus police. Probably I can't use my office because that's a publicly listed place, and if I had regular office hours, as I usually do, that would be publicly posted and such. And I've been outside of Bloomington for most of this fall, and you know, there's something nuts about that. I mean, really, college, you know, it's a sport. It's a game. I mean, that people should take it so seriously and it become, and to threaten people who they don't know in various ways and to disrupt the academic process, you know, that seems to me so far beyond reasonable bounds. I've got to tell you, it has not been the best experience of my life living through this whole thing. But when I spoke up about Bob Knight, I was aware of consequences, although I did not expect them to be this dire. I think it occurred because his fans realized that he might get fired, and then he did get fired, and they went into a frenzy about this.
Thank you.
All right. Gets at your question. Very good. We are here, got about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and introducing again our guest. We're talking with Murray Sperber. He's a professor of English and American Studies at Indiana University Bloomington and has written several books about college sports. And the most recent, the one here we're talking about this morning, is titled Beer and Circus, How Big-Time College Sports is Crippling Undergraduate Education. It's published by Henry Holt and in bookstores now. And your questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's another caller in Washington, line number three. Hello.
Hi. It seems to me that the focus on college sports is a little bit of a diversion. The thing that's really, I think, is really affecting undergraduate education is that universities are so focused on research and so focused on doing research in this country on the cheap that you have university money being diverted to research and undergraduates and the state legislature subsidizing research. You also have, just because we won't pay research assistants enough money, you fill the positions with research assistants from other countries, and so Silicon Valley is about a third people who came here and got masters and PhDs at wages that Americans wouldn't take for doing research. And I'd like to hear what you have to say about that.
Well, essentially, you're describing the first third of my book. And yeah, no, you won't get an argument from me that schools are putting billions into it. But as I described, they don't have all of those billions. And they do indeed try to do it on the cheap. But I guess the real impact on undergraduate education very often is graduate students come here for research, and the university wants them to focus on it, and then it says, oh, by the way, to earn your not very generous salary, you've got to teach these sections of lecture courses or teach other courses and such. And I know one of the complaints that occurred over and over again in my polling was undergraduates saying, complaining about foreign student graduate teaching assistants. Either they had language problems, the undergraduates couldn't understand them. I remember one woman, there were cultural problems. One woman saying she had this math TA who was from a Muslim country who didn't believe that women should speak up in class. And so This is a huge problem for many universities, and I agree that it's because they're trying to do the research. They don't have all the research and money that they would like. Very frankly, at the end of the book, I call for a different system, a more European system, which has, in Europe, there are research institutes. There are some in our country, of course, that are very successful. And I think research should be done there, and they should hire people and such. But they shouldn't burden the young researchers by also having them teach.
I think that's a wonderful idea. I think a good first step would be to say no federal funding for research that doesn't pay a competitive wage.
Right.
So that if you're going to hire somebody, you got to pay the same wage as would be paid in industry.
Right.
So if someone's coming from a foreign country to be a researcher, it's because they're a wonderful person in the field, not because they're available cheap.
Right. Exactly. And I also suggest, you know, let's have a little market prevailing here, where many universities' research, as you point out, is subsidized not only by the federal government but by state governments, and often it's very questionable research. I think, you know, if you had private institutes and such, or even public ones, the good ones would survive, the bad ones would disappear without a trace, and nothing would be lost. And graduate school could be much more devoted to pedagogy, teaching people who want to teach undergraduates and who want to devote their careers to that. And undergraduate teachers should be hired much more for teaching ability and teaching interests than strictly research interests as now. So it's really a system that's in dire need of change for many of the reasons you point out.
We here are in the point. We have about 5 minutes left. I have a couple of other callers. We'll try to get them both. We have someone calling from a car phone next. That's line two. Hello.
Hi. I'm a professor at the university here, and your analysis of the research bias is just completely inaccurate. The math department, and I'm not in the math department, hires TAs because they teach service courses to the university. The math department uses up almost no research funds. You don't really need much in order to do math research. The College of Engineering and those departments are very heavily research oriented, but there is absolutely no indication outside of the freshman service courses that the undergraduates in the College of Engineering are at all disadvantaged by having professors who do research or who have TAs who speak proper English teaching some of the courses. We're also talking about the university and education, but what does that have to do with LAS or the Commerce College? I think that this attempt to talk about the whole university as a one group and how various things affect the quality of education doesn't work. I think you have to break it down into college by college. I think you have to break it down into department by department. I would ask whether students who can name the number one football team in the country, I absolutely don't know what that is, but they can't name the number one school in graduate or undergraduate education in their own field. I mean, the kids have been distorted long before they got to the university. It happened in high school.
Could I reply to that?
We should do that since we're kind of
right.
Close to the end. Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, the good news for this caller is I got to write a whole long book, and I do divide it into departments. I talk about psychology. I question why they teach freshmen in classes of 500 and such. I do talk about the University of Illinois and its differences and similarities nationally. But I guess the best response is I have a chapter called Great Researcher, the Myth of Great Researcher Equals Great Teacher. And it's real simple. Quality teaching, particularly undergraduate teaching, is very labor intensive. You've got to spend time with a student. You've got to make sure that he or she understands the concepts and all of that. But quality researching is very labor intensive also. And so we're talking about two labor-intensive areas that take each takes 30 to 40 hours a week. So that's like 70 to 80 hours. So no one can do that. And if the rewards are on the research side, it just stands to reason that it's the undergraduate teaching that gets neglected. Now, I grant you, departments are different. My own department at Indiana has a commitment to teaching and does a better job than many others, but less so than others. But it's that labor-intensive question that you just can't get past when you examine this question.
One more here in Champaign. Line one. Hello.
Hello. I'm here at the University of Illinois. I just live here, but I came here as a student in the 60s and attended the school over the years several times. And the thing that I noticed was that I found it rather appalling that in the 70s, a beer company was sponsoring the Marching Illini.
Right.
And they still do. Right. And how can they expect anything but what has happened when the university will accept that kind of monies from those those people?
Right. You know? No, there's no question about it. The main sponsors of college sports and college sports events are the beer companies and the NCAA. Yeah, they're main sponsors, and they want that money. Athletic departments want that money, and universities go along with it, meanwhile decrying. It's really a plague, the kind of binge drinking. I think a lot of people who went to school in previous generations don't realize the amount of alcohol consumed by students today. The Harvard School of Public Health has done excellent studies of this, and they don't divide schools between schools where students drink and don't drink. I think the only stone-cold sober schools in America are probably Brigham Young and Bob Jones, but they divide it into high-binge schools and low-binge schools, and high-binge tends to be schools where many students are alienated from the academic process through these lecture courses and other things, where there's big-time college sports that the students love, very large fraternity and sorority systems, such as at Illinois, and many bars and sports bars that line the campus, such as in your town and my town and throughout the Big Ten, and a kind of nightly drinking scene, not just in previous eras and at low binge schools, it's a kind of weekend scene, but at many high binge schools, it's nightly. I know I visited many of these schools and seen the nightly scene, and it happened last week. I was in Houston. My daughter goes to Rice University, and the students there during the week tend to go to class and study at night, but on the weekend they certainly party, sometimes in conjunction with college sports, sometimes not. And so I guess my aims are sort of modest in this book to get schools to move from high binge to low binge, to get them to emphasize undergraduate education again, and get better control of their college sports programs. And I think one of the results will be better control of this whole huge partying scene that goes on at many of these schools.
Well, there we will have to stop because we've come to the end of the time. We want to say thank you very much, Professor Berber, for talking with us once again.
Thank you. I've been on this for every book, but this one provoked far more calls than any of the other ones.
It did indeed. Well, and if people would like to look at the book, it's titled Beer and Circus, How Big-Time College Sports is Crippling Undergraduate Education, published by Henry Holt and Company.